Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and once again, glad you are joining me as we talk about some classic and not-so-classic baseball cards. And we've got some not-so-classic ones, but some classic ones as well, and a very interesting mix of retail joy. Have you ever gone to one of those stores? Typically a drugstore. They sell them now. Not too many grocery stores or Walmarts or Targets. But have you ever gone into the toys section of your local drugstore? They're kind of small these days. I remember when I was a kid, the toy aisle was an actual aisle, not a mere like 4x8 space of cheap toys. But you've seen these before. Selling for just a few bucks, you can get 100 or in some cases 200 randomly selected repackaged baseball cards for an incredibly low price. And I actually did it this week. Yes, with a little trepidation, because that 82 Donruss fun pack that we opened up a couple months ago has still scarred me, the forced fun. I don't know if I ever want to sink my dollars into anything like that again. But I kind of got in the jam this week, and it's just timing. You know, we don't have too many great baseball card shops here in Tampa Bay anymore. You know, there's a couple. But they're a little bit of a drive from where I live. And also this past Tuesday when I got this idea, the other one that's a little closer, a little more direct for me to drive to, was closed. They close on Tuesdays. So it's just like, well, okay, I guess I can't just go to these card shops and see what I can find. Have a topic to discuss on, you know, Wax Ecstatic this time around. And I've got some great questions and topics that were brought up on our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains. But I felt like, you know, I need something to open, to share. Sure, I've got some 1948 Leaf cards I'll get around to. And while I do have that 89 Bowman rack pack, but I didn't want to unleash the fury of that because Nathan McNeely made a donation to our PayPal tip jar. So, Clash, you all owe Nathan McNeely a thank you, because he saved me from unleashing the fury of an 89 Bowman rack pack on you. And we'll get to Nathan. He made some great comments and a suggestion for an upcoming show, which I'll take him up on. But anyways, you know, I just didn't have a whole lot to talk about. You know, I've been so busy. I haven't really had time to go on eBay and stock up on some old wax or you know, at the local card show that we have here once a month. I just haven't been able to load up on some of the boxes like I did earlier this year. And the card show doesn't come around until next weekend, the 16th and 17th. So I'm thinking, well, what am I going to do? So I'm out and about and I go, well, let me just swing by Walmart and Target and see, you know, maybe they've got something on clearance. Or maybe they've got one of those, you know, track down the 52 tops pack boxes. You know what I'm talking about. They don't actually sell those anymore. But, you know, they put together like 20 wax packs into one big box for 20 bucks. And even that's a risk. That's normally garbage. You normally only get about four or five decent packs and then just a whole bunch of trash from the early 90s and some, you know, knockoff cards that somebody just decided to make one day and they're stuck with a bunch of leftovers. So I go to Walmart and I find actually a box of 2019 Topps Heritage that for some reason was marked down $5. It was on clearance. And it wasn't the update series. It wasn't the high number series. But still, yeah, you get eight packs for, I think it was $14. So I bought that just for myself. I figured, all right, I'll just go ahead and get this because it's on sale. I have no idea why. They have a whole bunch of 2018 stuff that wasn't marked down yet. But the 2019 stuff was for whatever reason. But there really wasn't anything else there. And then I, you know, went over to Target and, you know, struck out there as well. So I'm sitting there thinking, I'm like, well, you know, I've already done a show about 2019 Topps Heritage and comparing it to 1970 Topps. So what am I going to do? Let me just try. Let me go. There's a Walgreens not too far from my house. Let me swing back around towards the Walgreens. And you know that the Christmas holiday stuff, the toys are all out, even though we're still 3 weeks away from Thanksgiving. And, you know, maybe they've got one of those just mystery packs of cards. And I walk into a Walgreens, and sure enough, they have not one but two of these mystery packs of 100 cards that excitedly tells you that there's 100 cards in here. There's also a bonus pack of cards, and one in every four packs contains a hit. So what exactly is a hit for these cards? Well, it could be an autographed relic. It can be, you know, game-used item. You know, it's the autographs and the relic cards, stuff like that. And it was only like $6. So I figured, why the hell not? Here we go. This is it. And I had my expectations way, way low. I just went, yeah, this is not going to be good, but we'll make the best of it. And I bought it. And let me tell you, nothing humbles you more than realizing you're in a Walgreens in the middle of a Tuesday afternoon buying baseball cards. This is where you go, yeah, I need to pick up some more freelance work. What the hell am I doing in a Walgreens Tuesday afternoon buying baseball cards? Especially this crap. So anyways, I buy it and I take it home. And we posted the video. If you just look up Wax Ecstatic on YouTube, by the way, just type in Wax Ecstatic Walgreens Pack Break, you will find some of the gems. And yes, they were actual gems that we got in this pack. And it was certainly, from a monetary standpoint, it was certainly worth the $6. Like if you go book value for some of these cards, there's actually a pretty good return on your investment, which surprised me. And as I will get to a little later in the program, this $6 100 card potpourri of stuff that's been released by the major card manufacturers over the past 35 years was actually a better buy than the $14 I spent on the Topps Heritage at Walmart. So what's the old saying? Don't judge a book by its cover. Well, don't judge a pack of random baseball cards by the 2008 Topps Jared Weaver on the top of the stack. As, that was my choice. It was Jared Weaver and somebody, I couldn't see who it was, but somebody from the Milwaukee Brewers from like 2007. That was the top card on the other part or the other pack that was at Walgreens. So we'll talk about that pack in just a few minutes. But first, we've got to do a little housekeeping. As you know, we have Wax Ecstatic coming your way every other Friday here via our home base at Audio Boom, and also everyone else who grabs the RSS feed, notably Apple Podcasts, also Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, and Spotify. And like I said, anyone else who grabs onto that feed, it comes out every other Friday. So our next show, 2 weeks from today, Friday, November 22nd. And I'll have to get to work on that one pretty soon because I will actually be flying out to beautiful Tuscaloosa, Alabama with my son. We're going to catch the Alabama-Western Carolina game. That should be a barn burner the following Saturday. But I'm going to be working on that. And like I said, the card show is in town next weekend. So hopefully I can grab something from there and make it worth our while. So we'll find out what hijinks and hilarity are up for that show. But make sure you mark your calendar again. The 22nd of November is when we will be releasing that next show. Look for the video break on Thursday, November the 21st. And also make sure if you aren't already doing so, follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains and share the podcast and share the Twitter feed with your friends, current collectors or former collectors of this hobby. We always enjoy hearing from everybody, even those of you who haven't collected in like 30 or so years. We love bringing up some memories as we like to dive into the cards from the 50s and 60s and 70s every now and then, not just a focus on the quote-unquote junk wax. Now, speaking of Wax and Gum Stains, got a few DMs, also some messages on Wax and Gum Stains, including an email from Nathan regarding the suggestion that he had. So let's get right to that before we talk about this hidden Walgreens gem that I found earlier this week. First of all, from Tim Curry. No, not the actor. In fact, that is actually his handle on Twitter. No, not the actor. I can only imagine, Tim, how many emails or tweets, I should say, you get from people who talk about how great you were as Pennywise in It, or how much they love you as the butler in the movie Clue, and of course, Rocky Horror Picture Show. So, Tim, I'm sure you get plenty of strange requests and questions, but thank you so much for writing us. And he goes on to say, hey, Matt, thanks for the follow. I just discovered your podcast this week and have pretty much not listened to anything else since. Well, my apologies, Tim. Soon to be 54 years old, the 1970s are my nostalgic era. I started collecting in 1974. And began buying complete sets from Renata Galasso in 1978. Like many, I quit as I got older and started driving, then returned just in time for the junk wax era. Now, he also brought up a suggestion here. He says, the reason why he reached out to me is he would love to hear my take on the Hostess cards and the Kellogg's 3D cards of the 1970s. Any chance they'll be the subject of a future podcast? Well, you know, we've talked off and on about Hostess cards, you know, kind of the, I don't want to say non-official, but, you know, not the cards that were the base sets, shall we put it, from, you know, not just the 1970s, but really the entire spectrum of collecting. And we actually did a Mucho Miscellaneous show back in 2017. It's episode number 68 if you go pouring through our archives. And it's all about just kind of the random collection of cards that you end up getting outside of the base sets or the cards that you're really zeroing in on. And those are like the all-star glossy cards that you used to get in the Topps rack packs in the 80s, or you would get, you know, like Boardwalk and Baseball was one, or the collectibooks in the 80s, the glossy cards that you could send off, you know, a certain number of wrappers and $6 or whatever it was to Topps, and you would get a complete set throughout the 1980s. And then you had the really weird stuff. And I remember from that show talking about a card featuring Will Clark and his dog from like 1992 or something. It was like Milkbone was making baseball cards. Everybody was making baseball cards back then. So you had the bizarro cards like that. I mentioned Boardwalk and Baseball had their own set. I also remember from Ultra Pro, the company that made those plastic sleeves, Danny Tartable was a spokesperson for Ultra Pro. So Danny Tartable had an Ultra Pro card that was randomly inserted into these plastic pages. So there's a lot covered in that show, including cards from like Ralston Purina and Post and Kellogg's. But I did tell Tim, because it's been a while that we've discussed that, and I've never been a huge fan of those cards, mostly again because I collected the you know, the name brand stuff and the officially licensed stuff. I never really liked the cards that didn't have team logos or word marks on it because it wasn't officially recognized either by the Players Association or Major League Baseball. So they never really appealed to me. Now, that was sometimes the case in those serial cards, if you will, of the 1960s and 70s. Other times it was officially licensed and they can use word marks. But what I did tell Tim is that, and starting with this upcoming show that I'm going to be at, I will keep an eye out for those because those are the cards that are typically found in bargain bins. And they're bargain bins because there's only so many people that collect them. You know, there is demand for them because there is a rarity quality to it, mostly because, especially if you're talking about the back of a cereal box from 1974, you know, it was a cereal box. It got crumpled in the grocery cart. It got crumpled in the grocery bag. It got crumpled when you and your kid sister took the, you know, the Lucky Charms out of the cabinet and poured yourself a bowl of Lucky Charms. And then, of course, when you decided to cut the baseball cards out, you were not very good with scissors. So they kind of got all choppy and deckle-edged by accident. So, you know, there is a rarity quality to it. If you can find a properly sized, uncreased 1976 Mike Schmidt Kellogg's card or Hostess card, whatever, then good for you. And even if it wasn't the back of the box, if it was an insert, you know, you went shuffling through your cereal or your loaf of bread or, you know, whatever the product was that these cards were included with, chances are it wasn't exactly mint condition coming out, because again, it was just kind of floating around with the rest of the product. Or, you know, maybe you had those Topps Burger King cards in the late 70s. You slathered by accident some French fry grease all over these cards. So there is a rarity value to them. I was just never a big collector of them. So I am going to keep an eye on it. And, you know, Tim also brings up, you know, hey, I know that your podcast is about cards that are in your collection, but, you know, can you look into this? Yeah, you know, like I said, I will actually look out for those cards the next opportunity I get a chance to buy some. But also, I think that's one thing that makes this podcast so special is that this is not just some random review of any cards. This is something that I had in my collection, and it's in my collection, so I have a little more of an attachment to it. I have a little more of a passion for it, and I'm very happy to share these stories and these memories, as well as my knowledge of these particular cards, because I grew up with them, and in some cases, I still, 25, 30 years later, still have these cards sitting around in boxes. So a great conversation, Tim. I'm so glad that you were able to find us as well, and I really appreciate your comments. And like I said, if I can find any kind of Kellogg's or Hostess or Burger King or Coca-Cola cards, I can get them at a good price, I will snatch them up, and if we can have a small collection of them, we'll talk a little more in depth about those particular cards and the players in an upcoming show. Now, Nathan McNeely, as I said, Clash, you all owe Nathan a big thank you, because he saved you from seeing the 89 Bowman cards, although I may unleash that fury later, because the bonus pack that was in this Walgreens pack, it's a doozy, and I may unleash a double barrel fury of junk wax on you at some point in time. But Nathan made a very nice donation. Thank you very much. And you can too, by the way, at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. Nathan writes, recently stumbled on your podcast and instantly subscribed. Well, thank you very much, Nathan. I'm also a veteran of the junk wax era and love the content of your show. Keep it going. Recommend a segment on the 92 Fleer Ultra someday. I always liked this mass-produced, quote-unquote, premium card, and the subsets were manageable back then. Well, Nate, if you go through the archives, you'll find our original show on 92 Fleer Ultra, episode 54. That was also done back in 2017. And our random pull from the small collection of 92 Fleer Ultra that I still have was Albert Bell. And I've loved 92 Fleer Ultra as well as 93. You know, 93 was not all that different from 92, but both sets were very well done. They certainly took premium to a new level, left the base set that Fleer was producing in the dust at the time, and I thought was arguably the best premium set to come out in 1992. In 1993. Now, Stadium Club in 92 and 93 was pretty good. And of course, Upper Deck, even though it was a base set, was still pushing out some good stuff. And you had the Leaf Studio set, which was outstanding at that point in time. And, you know, several other sets that were being made in the early to mid 90s that were at the premium level. But I've always liked Fleer Ultra. It is the perfect combination of star power, rookie power, great photography. You have the UV coating, all sorts of pictures on the back. And I mentioned this in episode 54. You can find 92 Fleer Ultra for an incredibly cheap price. The same can be said for 91 Fleer Ultra. We did a show on that not too long ago. But 91 Fleer Ultra left a lot to be desired, where in 92, Fleer definitely got it right. They hit this one out of the park and, like I said, pretty much replicated that set. It was so good in 1993. So, and you can buy boxes, I think, for online, like $10 to $12, which is kind of surprising. Now, again, you have to pay shipping and handling, so it comes out to about $25 or $30, depending on where you're getting it from. But I will keep an eye out for the Fleer Ultra, and in fact, with your donation, I will be looking at possibly buying some, see if I can scour the interwebs to see if I can get a good deal on some Fleer Ultra. Now, the 88 Score podcast, which we did last week, or 2 weeks ago, I should say, a lot of love for 88 Score. Our good friend C.D. Anderson chimes in. You should have doubled down and got two 88 Score boxes and built a set. And he's also going on about the My Thanks But No Thanks box. We'll get to that in a minute. CD, I have to tell you, I thought about it, but I have a hunch. I actually haven't, believe it or not, I still have the rest of that box to open up. Because there's only 660 cards and there were 17 cards in each pack, I believe I can probably get a full set or very close, you know, probably be about 10 or 15 cards shy if I open up that whole box. Like I said, I've just been so busy the last few weeks, I haven't really gotten around to it. But I will hedge my bets that I can still find the 88 score set, pull it all together from that one box. And then that way I don't buy two boxes where I complete the set, but then I've got about, you know, 500 cards that I don't really want. So I appreciate your comments, though. But again, I decided to stay on my budget and just buy that one box for $6 as opposed to two for $11. Now, he goes on to talk about his Thanks But No Thanks box. And this was just as a refresher. When I was buying this box of 88 score at the show, the guy had a whole bunch of late 80s and early 90s boxes that he was selling $6 a piece or two for $11. And I was looking at all the other boxes, and there's 91 Fleer, that's a no thanks. 89 score, that's definitely a no thanks. And then, 90 Fleer. And as I've mentioned, I have a very soft spot for 90 Fleer because of some great childhood memories of buying those packs. And at first I picked up the box and I'm thinking, all right, that's my second box. But then as I'm holding it and looking at it, I'm like, what the hell am I going to do with 90 Fleer? It's just... yeah, there's a lot of great memories, but this is one of those sets where even I had to put it back and just go, nah, you know, I'd rather just get the $6 box than go for the two for 11. So C.D. Anderson's Thanks But No Thanks box would be any Donruss from 88 through 91. Now, you all know how much of a softy I am for 88 Donruss. It is just unfair how beaten down the redheaded stepchild of Junk Wax is. 88 Donruss was actually not a bad set. There was just way too much of it, and just like every other set that was produced in 1988, didn't have the star power or the panache of the cards that were released in 1987. So it kind of gets a bad rap, and because there's so much of it still out there, yeah, you better believe that, a lot of people just don't like 1988 Donruss. But 89 Donruss, I've always liked. I think that doesn't get a fair rap. 90 Donruss, well, we all know how most of the hobby thinks of that. And of course, 91 Donruss, as one of our listeners absolutely rightly called it, the Christmas sweater set of the 1990s. Yes, it is a very 1991 looking set. In the Thanks But No Thanks department, Kirby Thomas Jr. writing 1990 Donruss, thought I'd never buy it again, but I was proved wrong when the opportunity to buy at $3 a box presented itself, so I bought two. He goes on to add, the after school program at my elementary school had a baseball card collecting club that gave that out. Must have had 1,000 already, so good nostalgia. All right, so that was one that you couldn't pass up, but there were others that could, including Robert J. Lawson. He said, even if it's just a few dollars, I do my best to resist any Junk Wax box temptation. I'd be stuck with so many commons that I'd have to find a spot for or deal with getting rid of, unless it's 87 Tops or 87 Fleer or 88 Fleer or 89 Tops or 89 Upper Deck, or, and then he kind of trails off, realizing, nah, chances are you would probably end up still buying it. And then Brian Kilby, some interesting comments from Brian we'll get to in just a moment, but on the Thanks But No Thanks department, 87 Tops, it's my all-time favorite set, but after purchasing so many cheap vending boxes over the years, I just can't do it anymore. And I'll be honest with you, Brian, I've had the opportunity to pick up 87 Tops pretty cheap, too. You can still get wax boxes at card shows for $8, $10 in many cases. And I remember seeing 87 Tops again for a pretty good price at a recent show and just kind of passing by it. And I think it's because, you know, I had a love affair with 87 Tops going back, to the early 90s with cello boxes that I would buy and sets that I would assemble. And recently, while just kind of cleaning up my collection, I've got boxes stored in a big cardboard box, and I was shuffling through those, trying to organize them to where, all right, the boxes that I don't really, you know, touch, they're going to go down at the bottom of the big box and put some smaller boxes on top. And I have not one, not two, but three complete hand-collated 87 top sets. So, yeah, I'm pretty good on the 87 tops, and while it's a lot of fun to open up 87 tops and get some pretty good cards out of it at a bargain, I just didn't want to, dive into those too much anymore. Now, Brian touches up on a couple of other topics that we brought up in the last program. I asked you, who is the one player that you always seem to pull out of every pack? And I mentioned Zane Smith. For much of my big-time collecting era from 89 to 93, it seemed like practically every pack of new cards had a Zane Smith card in it. And Brian adds Juan Beniquez. I've had a few of those. He retired in 88, and basically any pack or stack of cards I would get from the 70s or 80s would always have a Juan Beniquez card in there. I ended up picking up his rookie card recently, and it's now proudly displayed with the other prized cards in my collection. Well, I'm glad that you've got a little bit of a sense of humor about it, because it can drive you crazy if you get pack after pack after pack, and you end up just keep getting the same guy over and over and over and over again. Going back to Robert J. Lawson mentioning that Mike Pagliarulo and Teddy Higuera were his cards that just kept coming back in droves. So he could basically wallpaper his house with the Mike Pagliarulo and Teddy Higuera cards from the late 80s and early 90s. Now, another topic that Brian touched on, vending boxes, he says, and speaking of vending boxes, and I did mention this in a recent show, I was a grown adult before I realized vending boxes fed vending machines. I've never run across a card vending machine. I'd be interested in knowing more about vending history, if that could be stretched into podcast form someday. Well, I don't think you can get a full 60-minute show out of it, at least about the vending history. You could have some fun actually opening up a vending box and going through all the cards to see what's in there. But the skinny of it is just like any other treat, baseball cards have been distributed through vending machines going back to the 1950s. And in fact, and I shared this with Brian, I found some 1950s and 1960s era vending machines that used to dispense not only baseball cards, but bubblegum. You can buy them on eBay, depending on the condition, for anywhere from about $300 or $400 to upwards of $2,000. And I know that I have made it financially if one day I actually buy one of those things. You know, right now, my wife would kill me if I bought one of those. But they are just so cool because there are two columns, and in the middle, there's the bubblegum column. So you fill it up with those little round bubblegum balls. And you have, one stack of cards on the left and one stack of cards on the right. And you put the top on and you put in, a dime or whatever the coin is. And when you turn the crank, a gumball would come up. But also, typically two or three cards would get pushed out from one of the columns, depending on which column you put the money in. So that was how they were designed in the 1950s and 60s. And then once you got into the 70s and 80s, the vending machines went away from the bubblegum dispersal into more of the stereotypical vending machines that you saw at the front of a Walmart. And you know what I'm talking about, the vending machines that you put in a quarter and a hologram sticker came out, or a shiny sticker, or a fake tattoo, something like that, whatever junk you can sell for 25 cents. And I remember seeing one of those vending machines. In fact, I started the discussion about the Renata Galasso set several months ago with a vending machine story, how I ended up with a Duke Snider Renata Galasso card back when I was like 13 or 14 years old at a card show. I was down to my last 50 cents and there was this vending machine. I just stuck my quarters in there and pushed the coins in, and out came three or four cards. One of them was the Duke Snider card, which I thought back then was just kind of a cheap knockoff. Yet, all these years later, I held on to it and then, kind of discovered the Renata Galasso story this past year. So vending machines have been around for a while. I think they used to be staples in card shops, but unfortunately, the vending machine craze kind of died down, and simply because, you know, if you've ever bought a vending box, you get 500 cards out of it, but you know, the chances of pulling a star card, you know, it's just like if you just took a random 500 cards out of any factory set, you know, you'll get a star card one out of every, you know, 15 or 20 cards. So you'd have to dump a lot of change into these things. But, you know, like in the case where, you know, I was just down to my last 50 cents at a card show, if you just have some spare change and you plunk the quarters in there, it's interesting just to see what comes out. Another example, and it wasn't a vending machine, it was actually an arcade machine. Back in the early 90s, I recall it was a pinball machine. There's a couple of different baseball arcade games. One that you see now has this kind of little miniature bat on it, and you flip the bat to knock a ball into, you know, a category, you know, base hit, double, home run, whatever. But I remember I think it was more of a full-fledged pinball game back in the early 90s, where you would play a couple of innings, and at the end of the game, no matter how many points you got, the machine would spit out two or three cards. And I remember it was early 90s because I used to get these 91 Topps cards that came out. And while that is not a true vending machine, I would imagine the inner workings of that pinball machine was probably very similar to a vending machine, where if you had this particular game in your store, then you would put in a vending box of cards, and then that way the machine, like I said, would spit out two or three cards with every game. So the actual vending machine, they stopped really pushing those in the mid-90s. In fact, if you do a vending box search online, you normally don't see anything past, I'd say, 95 or 96. So that's kind of when the vending machine craze, if you will, died down. It wasn't really a craze, but it was an option for people to push product out there. So that is why they're called vending boxes, because going as far back as the 1950s, you could actually put stacks of cards into vending machines. Although the vending box didn't really materialize, I want to say, until the 60s. So in the 1950s, you're probably just opening up a bunch of packs and just stuffing the cards in there. But yeah, they were actual vending machines for baseball cards, specifically for baseball cards in the 50s and 60s, more routine looking vending machines in the 70s and 80s and into the early 90s. But that is how they got the name vending box, because yes, indeed, they were actually put inside vending machines or vending like machines. Like I said, that particular baseball pinball game that I remember in the early 1990s. But if you are interested in vending machines, all you have to do is just do an internet search, because people do have these, the older ones and the more current ones. And I, like I said, if I just happen to have an extra $1,000 laying around that I could spend on just something completely superfluous, that would be it for me. I would love to just have a vending machine that I could stuff some old baseball cards in and charge people a quarter to see what kind of cards they get. All right, a couple other questions real quickly to get to. First of all, from Ryan Cornell. Hi, Matt. Would you consider doing a feature on Mike Miley? Would be interested in getting your take on his story. Well, Mike Miley was an infielder for the California Angels, a starting quarterback for LSU, but he walked away from his senior year at LSU in 1975, became a shortstop with the Angels, was likely going to be a star player for the Angels. However, died in a one-car crash outside of New Orleans, I believe, in 1977, I think it was. And it was an all too tragic story. His career cut very short there, obviously. Died at the age of 23. And an interesting story, again, that he walked away from the top quarterback job at LSU for a chance to take some bonus money with the Angels and try to make a go of it, of his major league career. That's about all I have on Mike Miley. I do know that he was part of a tough stretch of crashes that took baseball players' lives in the mid to late 70s. Bob Moose was one. I'm not talking about the big, well-known ones like Thurman Munson and Roberto Clemente, but I'm talking about, of course, like Lyman Bostic, who was, a double whammy there for the Angels there. He was supposed to be the star outfielder, and he was shot and killed in the late 70s. Who is the other one? It was Carl Morton. That's who I was thinking of. Carl Morton was a pitcher for the Atlanta Braves in the late 70s. He died in the early 80s. So there was this stretch of about 7 or 8 years of just really tragic accidents with a lot of baseball players. But I know that Mike Miley was part of that. And like I said, I think it was 1977. And it was, again, an interesting story. Of course, you know, the SEC and, you know, LSU football, not quite at the national stage that it is nowadays. But still, you're the starting quarterback. You're the big man on campus at LSU. And you walk away from your senior year to take some bonus money and an opportunity to play Major League Baseball with the Angels. And of course, again, he was a prospect. There was a chance that he was going to develop into a regular Major League player and tragically died all too soon. So Ryan, thank you very much for sending me that note. Also, Ryan sent me an email, and he was listening back to some of the previous podcast. And I mentioned a few times that Carlton Fisk was a jerk to me during a spring training game. What happened there? Well, Ryan, as I shared with you in the email, if you go back to episode 102, which was kind of my first sign-off of the podcast, took a little bit of a hiatus after that one, I went back, and this was not a random card, but it was one I purposely picked because I was taking a break, and that was Dave Steeb's rookie card in 1980. So we talked a little bit about 1980 Tops, but also how Dave Steeb was my favorite pitcher, certainly, and arguably my favorite player at the time. And I was, I'll give you the short version of the story because longtime listeners have heard the story before. You've read the story. In fact, if you want to do a Google search, just type in Matt Salmon, Toronto Blue Jays, and you will find an article that I wrote about my experience a few years ago. But the short version is I was very lucky in the spring of 1991. It was my first spring training game that I had gone to. And being a Blue Jays fan and having the team train in Dunedin, which is about an hour from where I grew up, it was a thrill to be able to see the Toronto Blue Jays live in action. They were playing the Chicago White Sox. It was April 1991. And I was pulled from a crowd of kids to be a bat boy for the game. And I mean, I was just in heaven. I was just in a daze. And it shows because I was a terrible bat boy. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But they put me in a Blue Jay uniform, which was just an absolute thrill for a, how old was I, 13-year-old kid. And they put me at the White Sox dugout. And my main jobs were to collect the bats that players dropped, you know, when they got on base, and to supply the home plate umpire with baseballs from a big bucket of balls. And like I said, I didn't do either of those jobs rather well. I thought I did then, but I really didn't. I was really terrible at what I did. But I remember Dave Steeb was on the mound, so that was cool. I get to see my hero pitching. And 1991, I think, was his last completely healthy season in the major leagues. He had a lot of arm trouble in 92, and days after the Jays won the World Series in 92, he was cut and ironically would end up with the White Sox in 1993. But I remember Dave Steeb striking out Carlton Fisk, and Fisk was looking at strike three. And, you know, again, I'm just this delirious 13-year-old kid, and I go, you know, running up to Fisk and stick out my hand, you know, waiting for him to hand me his bat. And he was just slowly walking back to the dugout with his head down, contemplating strike three that he looked at. And here I am, you know, my 13-year-old voice.
Excuse me, Mr. Fisk. Excuse me. Can I have your... Have your bat, Mr. Fisk.
And he just wouldn't give it to me. And I was going to have to pry Carlton Fisk's bat from his cold, dead hands if I wanted it. So he walked away rather grumpily, and I was shunned and kind of went back to my little stool and continued screwing up everything in the game that you could imagine a bat boy could screw up. And that was that. It was a lot of fun, though, even though I was a terrible, terrible Bat Boy. All right, thanks for all of your questions, comments, everything from our Wax Ecstatic Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. And again, if you would like to make a donation to Wax Ecstatic, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And just know, as I like to remind you, that every dollar that comes into the show goes right back into the show. And that is in one of two ways: of keeping our home base alive and well at audioboom.com, keeping our archives free. Again, we could slap on a fee at some point to listen to the archives. I prefer not to do that, but it may come to that someday. So keep those donations coming so we can avoid doing that. And also, it keeps us bringing in product, and hopefully we'll step it up from the Walgreens pack of cards that we picked up here recently. But every dollar that comes in, we go out looking for products that we can buy and we can open up and talk about on this show. And again, if we have any excess product, it goes into boxes that we then later ship to Commons for Kids, who provide baseball cards to kids who can't afford cards or who are just in a tough situation. You know, maybe they're in the hospital, maybe they're dealing with some kind of illness, a terminal illness, or a long-term physical condition, and they just need something to cheer them up. Well, what better way to cheer up kids than a handful of baseball cards? And for the kids who can't afford cards, it keeps them in the hobby. And of course, when you're keeping them in the hobby, you're keeping them in the game, and chances are you're keeping them out of trouble. So we are always glad to donate cards to Commons for Kids. And Commons for Kids will be getting quite a few of the cards from this Walgreens pack here. I mean, I'll go through and pull out some of the 86 and 88 Topps cards that I might need to filter out my hand-collated sets here. But I would imagine probably about 90% of these cards are going to be going into the donation box, and that's okay. Because as I said, this pack of cards was a pleasurable surprise for me. As in past years, I had purchased these packs, not often, just kind of on a whim, and there was just a lot of garbage. There were, you know, there was a one-star card on top and then just a whole bunch of crap behind it. Or, especially with the packs, like I said before, if you buy that 20-pack mega box, there's only four or five decent packs in there, and the rest of the stuff is just garbage. And you're looking at it going, why did I spend $20 on this, or whatever the price is? And I was definitely still feeling the burn of the Donruss Fun Pack that was not fun, or as we called it, forced fun, because I spent, I want to say it was like $22 or $25 on that. And it's not the seller's fault. I mean, he's just reselling, you know, what was in retail. But you get that pack that had, what was it, I think 14 or 15 of the Donruss Super Big Baseball packs from 1984. And then you had the repackaged garbage from 1982. Thankfully, we didn't have that experience here. I was fully expecting it, but I was pleasantly surprised once you got past the 2008 Topps Jared Weaver. I'm not going to go card by card. Like I said, you can just watch the video break on YouTube to see it. But I was pleasantly surprised, first of all, with the star power. You actually had an 87 Topps Roger Clemens. You had an 86 Topps Dwight Gooden, a 91 Topps Dwight Gooden as well. You had some stars from today, or some recent stars, you know, an Aramis Ramirez upper deck card from not that long ago, a Mike Lowell card from, I think, 2000. So, you know, some pretty decent cards that were in there. And also, I managed to get one of the hit cards. Now, whether they actually do insert these on a 1-in-4 basis, I don't know. But the hit card, and we're going to talk about the player in just a little bit, Blake DeWitt, who was an infielder for the Dodgers about 10 or 12 years ago, I got an autographed Blake DeWitt card from Series 2 of 2009 Topps here. You look it up, if you, you know, depending on who's selling it, you know, you could value that card at anywhere from $8 to $12. So not that there's a hot market for 2009 autographed Blake DeWitt Topps Series 2 cards, but again, if you're looking strictly at the book value of these cards, was it worth $6? Absolutely. And if I were to look up every card that was in here, and again, there's probably about 10 to 15 star cards of value, Yeah, I probably could assemble roughly $15 to $20 worth of cards from this box. So from a value standpoint, this is actually a great value. I never thought I'd say this about those random assortment of cards that you find at your nearest drugstore, but in this particular case it was. So you had some star power. You also had a wide range of cards. The oldest card that we had a few from 85 tops. And the newest cards we had a few from 2018, including Topps and Bowman. So a pretty good assortment of cards. You had some big brands. You had some not so big brands. And I joke as we're going through some of the cards here from the early to mid 90s. I mean, everybody was making a baseball card back in like 92 and 93. So you have some real off-brand cards here. But, you know, some names from the past like Pacific and, of course, Classic Best and stuff like that. That was pretty neat. And then a real unexpected surprise, there was a random football card that was in there. So we had a little bit of a packaging error, but I will find some space in the Commons for Kids box for the Philadelphia Eagles tight end from 12 years ago that we got in the box. Now, would I go out and buy boxes and boxes of these cards? No, absolutely not, especially when, you know, a lot of these star cards or the hit cards, if you will, are cards you probably already have in your collection if you hung on to some of your junk wax stuff. Still, generally speaking, this was a pretty interesting pack of cards to open, and I'll actually enjoy, as I'm sorting through the ones that I'm going to keep, kind of looking through some of these cards and looking back and thinking about some of the cards that were made and some that I collected back in the late 80s and early 90s. A lot of them are in here. But also what's in here are cards that I didn't collect from that kind of dead time from 95 till about 2005, 2006. There are several cards from the late 90s and early 2000s that aren't in my collection. And I actually get a chance to look at them now and see if they were really as bad as I thought they were. Of course, I had bigger goals in life back then, you know, sleeping with every woman I could find and drinking every bottle of beer I could find. Baseball cards were not very high up on the demand there in my life. But obviously things have changed a little bit, married with two kids and just schlepping along here like everybody else. So it's kind of neat to look back at a lot of the cards that I bypassed over the years. So the verdict on this particular pack of cards, again, it's one of those things where for $6, it's why not? It was actually pretty good. I actually enjoyed opening up these cards as opposed to that crap that I had in the 82 Donruss Fun Pack. Now, I would suggest that you don't spend too much money on these, but if you just happen to be in a drugstore, because again, that's where most of these are sold, sometimes you'll find them in a Walmart or a Target, but this particular one I found at a Walgreens. But if you have a few bucks and you're just itching to open up some baseball cards and you want to see what is the interesting mix of cards in there, then this was not a bad purchase by any stretch of the imagination. Now, the one thing that did kind of reek from this was the bonus pack was, and you could tell, anybody who collects, you could just turn the side of the box over and you could see where the pack was. 1990 Donruss. Now, I was originally going to open this while I was going through all the cards, but with YouTube, you can only upload at least, you know, certainly for my current production equipment, you can only upload about 15 minutes of video at one time. So I was looking at the clock. We were at about 14 minutes. I'm like, no, I'm going to save this. So beware, friends. If we don't get the donations through paypal.me/waxecstatic, I will hit you over the head with 89 Bowman and 90 Donruss. Yes, we will dive into the junkiest of junk wax from 30 years ago. If you are not careful and if you are not charitable with your loose change to this program. So I did want to warn you about that. Now, some interesting stories that came up as I pulled four random cards here. One that jumped out at me because living here in Tampa Bay for much of my life, this name I chuckle at, I laugh at, I cry just a little bit, and I shake my head. Ben Grieve. Oh, we all remember Ben Grieve. In fact, I'm still curious if Ben Grieve even has a pulse these days. No, he is actually alive. By all accounts, he is still alive and well at the age of 43. But this guy made vanilla ice cream look exciting. This guy was, you've heard the term cool as a cucumber. This guy made a cucumber look like Frankenstein's creature. I mean, this guy just had, he was chill, but not in the cool way. You know, he was so relaxed. You sometimes wondered if a strong breeze came by, if it would knock him over. Well, Ben Grieve, of course, the son of Tom Grieve, former baseball player and general manager of the Texas Rangers, would get drafted by the Oakland Athletics second overall in the 1994 Major League Baseball draft. Now, there was some concern in the Oakland clubhouse back in the day that Grieve was being selected simply as a favor to Tom Grieve, which, of course, doesn't make sense in a lot of ways, but mostly because why would the A's do a favor for the Texas Rangers general manager? Nobody was really sure why. But you look back at the 1994 draft, you see names like Nomar Garciaparra, Paul Konerko, Jason Varitek, and some later picks that were in the draft, like A.J. Pierzynski and Troy Glaus and Aaron Boone, Russell Branyon, for example, Keith Foulke. I mean, there's a lot of other names of more successful players that were selected later on in that draft. So you look at Ben Grieve as the second overall pick and you go, yeah, that wasn't a very wise pick. But it actually was. He was an all-star player. In fact, in 1998, represented Oakland in the all-star game at Denver. And he was the American League Rookie of the Year in 1998. Had a hell of a rookie season for Oakland. It looked like the A's were finally turning the corner. You know, the very early stages of Moneyball happening in 1998. 155 games played, 18 home runs, a .288 batting average. Like I said, Rookie of the Year and All-Star. So things were looking up for Ben Grieve until the trade to Tampa Bay. Yes, part of a three-team trade in 2001, January of 2001. It involved the Devil Rays, the A's, and the Royals. So the A's sent Angel Barroa and A.J. Hinch to Kansas City. Kansas City sent Johnny Damon and Mark Ellis to Oakland. Of course, Damon would spend a couple years in Oakland before signing with Boston and winning a World Series there. The Devil Rays, meanwhile, sent Roberto Hernandez to Kansas City, Corey Lytle to Oakland, and they received Ben Grieve. Now, I remember this day. I was working at a local sports station at the time. I remember this deal, and this legitimately got the baseball audience excited because here was a rookie of the year. Here was an all-star. Here was a star outfielder and a young outfielder at the time. He was only, 24 going on 25 at the time. So as opposed to the over-the-hill stars of the hit show ad campaign for the Devil Rays in 2000, talking about Jose Canseco and Fred McGriff, as well as Vinny Castilla and Greg Vaughn, here you had a young guy who had a lot of upside who you thought, okay, this is a guy that's going to grow into a role here in Tampa Bay. Well, it actually turned out that he kind of grew into being a scourge in Tampa Bay. For one, because Corey Lytle was actually having a pretty successful stint in Oakland, and he would actually have a pretty decent career up until his tragic death in a plane crash in 2006. Meanwhile, Grieve, while he had a decent 2001 season, he hit .264 with 11 home runs in 154 games. In 2002, things started sliding backwards. He was dealing with a lot of injuries. His batting average drops to .251. Still put up 19 home runs, 64 RBI, so not bad considering he only played in 136 games. But then the bottom drops out in 2003. Not only is he dealing with injuries, but his extremely laid-back attitude made it look like he didn't care. And he became a piñata for Lou Piniella and then ultimately the Tampa Bay media and fans, because during a loss early in the season, supposedly Grieve said something to the tone of, you know, well, what's it matter, something like that. And that, of course, just made Piniella blow up. You know, what's it matter? Of course it matters. And, you know, he just kind of, you know, lit into him and basically painted Grieve as just this spoiled kid of a former major leaguer who's well beyond his great days and just doesn't care. He's lazy, he's entitled, and of course it matters. So the 2003 season would be the last in Tampa Bay for Greve. He would later go on to play in Milwaukee and Chicago, the Cubs in 2004, also played with the Cubs in 2005. Had a couple of spring training invites with the Pirates and the Cubs as well in 2005, but became a free agent after the 2005 season. And thankfully, before Lou Piniella got back into the game as the Cubs manager. Now, there's not a whole lot of news about Ben Greve other than the fact that he is still alive. He's 43 years old. And he's done some scouting work. That's pretty much it. He was part of the White Sox organization with Charlotte, their AAA farm club, in 2007. And there's just really not a whole lot about Ben Greve in the history books. He has just very quietly disappeared, much like he did on the field here in Tampa Bay. He very quietly disappeared, and Lou Piniella would not let anything quietly happen. All right, let's move on to a top prospect for 1991. We had a 91 Upper Deck Rico Bronya card. Oh, by the way, the Ben Greve card was a classic five-sport card from 1996. Just want to chalk it up there if you're keeping score at home. So 91 Upper Deck Rico Bronya card, and I kind of joked in the video break that this was not the hit card of the box. Rico Bronya was one of many hyped-up prospects in the early 1990s, of course, being a left-handed pull hitter in Tiger Stadium. You can only imagine the excitement that the Tigers thought they would have with Bronya, and you had Cecil Fielder and Rob Deere was still with the Tigers. So he had a lot of power in old Tiger Stadium, and they were going to try to make him take advantage of that porch in right field. Well, Rico Bronya, even though he didn't have quite the star rookie season in Detroit, and he's certainly somebody that you kind of look back at his career and you go, okay, well, that was pretty decent. He had a lot of ups and downs. Let's start off with where he came from Watertown, Connecticut, a three-sport star, basketball, football, and baseball. He was an all-state quarterback that won the state championship in Connecticut in 1986 and initially signed a letter of intent to play quarterback at Clemson, however, chose to pursue a career in baseball as the Detroit Tigers picked him up in 1992. He went back and forth between Detroit and Toledo, and in 1994 would join the New York Mets after a trade. Now, if you're looking for the answer to the trivia question, who hit the first home run in Coors Field, the Rockies' new stadium, in 1995, that would be, yes, Rico Bronya of the New York Mets. Now, his time in New York was very brief. He only played three seasons there. But not only was he a solid hitter, but an outstanding fielder. Never won a gold glove, but he always seemed to be in the right place at the right time. And he was part of a rebuilding Mets team that eventually would develop into the team that was a perennial playoff team in the late 90s and early 2000s. Now, he left New York kind of on a sour note, as he was diagnosed with spondylosis. That's a form of spinal arthritis. Now, he would take medication and do all kinds of stretches to help him out with this, but it was believed that this health diagnosis was part of the reason why the Mets traded him to the Phillies following the 1996 season. Now, I have cervical spondylitis. Spondylitis. Anyways, it's arthritis in the neck. And you've got bone spurs, you've got calcium deposits. I blew out a few discs in my neck a few years ago. And when it flares up, it is very painful. It's hitting, causes muscle spasms and hits nerves and gives you headaches. And it is not fun when it's at its worst. So I really feel for Rico Bronya. I know what he was going through when he was having to deal with this. And I can also tell you that one thing that does not help arthritis of any form is playing on the Veterans Stadium turf for 3.5 seasons like he did. He would later go on to Boston with the Red Sox tail end of the 2000 season, played briefly with the Atlanta Braves in 2001, and after he got shut down in July of 2001, he retired and went into coaching, not just with baseball, but also basketball and football back in Connecticut. He is also a cancer survivor, was diagnosed with testicular cancer back in 2015. team. And his last moments in baseball were with the Fightin' Phils, the minor league AA team of the Phillies farm system. He was a coach there for a couple of years. And this year he is away from baseball. And in fact, I saw a really, really good little kind of like a 30 for 30, a really good interview with Howie Rose and Rico Bronya that the Mets released just this past year. And he is getting into cybersecurity. He's going back into school and getting a master's in cybersecurity. So he is looking for a career and life change as he approaches the age of 50, which he will hit next April. Certainly wish him the best of luck with that. All right, the hit card that I had was the Blake DeWitt career best autograph card. It is a very nice card here. Like I said, you know, you could sell it for probably about 10 bucks if there's a market out there for it. Blake DeWitt began his professional career as the starting third baseman for the Ogden Raptors and was the second best prospect in the Pioneer League as well as the eighth best prospect in the Dodgers organization. He was a star shortstop at his high school in Sikeston, Missouri, and again was one of the top prospects in America at the time. The Dodgers drafted him in the first round of the 04 draft. He was supposed to go to Georgia Tech, but decided to go into Major League Baseball, or professional baseball, I should say. He was actually rated as the best high school pure hitter entering the draft. And why not? In his senior year, he hit .558 with 15 home runs, 11 doubles, and 48 RBI. Now, he would get his chance in the spring of 2008. There were injuries to Nomar Garciaparra, Andy LaRoche, and Tony Abreu. So DeWitt gets a chance to play at third base and would do very well for much of the 2008 season. That is until the Dodgers acquired Casey Blake. So he goes back to AAA, but does get a chance to get back up into the major leagues in the 2008 playoffs with Jeff Kent injured. And he would help playing second base for the Dodgers as they were able to get to the NLDS and NLCS that year. Now, with the Dodgers getting Orlando Hudson in a deal, he basically lost his chance of playing in Los Angeles. He goes back to AAA and then bounces around a few seasons with the Chicago Cubs and a brief appearance with the Atlanta Braves before getting cut loose in August of 2013, dealing with some injuries as well. Now, April 2008, that was a big time for Blake DeWitt, as it was declared that Blake DeWitt Month would be happening in April 2008 in his hometown of Sikeston, Missouri. And on November 25th, 2008, remember this after the Dodgers had a nice little playoff run here, DeWitt was presented with a key to the city and the Star of Sikeston Award by Mayor Mike Marshall. No, not the former pitcher Mike Marshall. Meanwhile, in the spring of 2009, his number 6 was retired by his high school team in Sikeston. He is married, has one kid, and we haven't heard much from Blake DeWitt since then. And then finally, Bob Hamlin, 1990 Upper Deck rookie card here. And the Bob Hamlin story is just amazing. You want a 30 for 30. Here's a good 30 for 30 for you. As Bob Hamlin, the American League Rookie of the Year in 1994, a guy who really had to fight his way to get into the major leagues, grabbed Kansas City and Major League Baseball by surprise with that outstanding rookie season, just kind of had his career wither away, and he walked away from baseball just at the age of 31, I believe it was, and just left. Now, he is back in baseball. I'll get to that in just a minute. But let's start out with his beginning, as he was born in Randolph, New Jersey. Family moved to Irvine, California. And he was a football and baseball star. He was the athlete of the year as a senior at Irvine High School. He was actually recruited to play football by Notre Dame. But much like we had Rico Bronya, turning away Clemson for baseball, Bob Hamlin, would turn down Notre Dame for Major League Baseball as well. And he was drafted by the Kansas City Royals in, I believe it was 1988. And he slowly but surely moves his way up through the organization, finally gets a chance in 1993. Now, he was dealing with back injuries. He had an eye issue as well. And of course, George Brett was still playing in the early 90s. Now, Brett was still kind of a designated hitter, but you could throw him out at first base every now and then. So finally, once Brett retires in 1993, the door opens in 1994, where Bob Hamlin, like I said, wins the American League Rookie of the Year award in the strike-shortened season. He hit .282 and hit 24 home runs with 65 RBI. His nickname was the Hammer. He broke the Royals' rookie home run record that was established by Bo Jackson. And it looks like Bob Hamlin is going to go to the moon afterwards. Well, that wouldn't happen. His number started sliding a bit in 1995. He got sent to AAA. Same thing happens in 1996. He's getting platooned. He's not going anywhere. So he signs with the Detroit Tigers in 1997. Isn't getting much of a shake with them. Latches on with the Brewers in 1998. Is kind of in a pinch-hitting role here. Of course, the Brewers moved to the National League in 98, so you don't have a DH opportunity there. And in 1999, he's back in the Tigers organization. He's playing with Toledo. He still has game, even though his numbers don't show it. The Tigers are a terrible team in 1999. He could get a call up at any moment. But he wasn't looking forward to it. So in a game against the Ottawa Lynx, Hamlin gets out at the plate. He comes walking back into the dugout, tells his manager, Gene Roof, I'm done. And Roof says, are you done for the game? He says, no, I'm done for good. And he just walks away. He leaves the game, leaves the stadium, and never goes back. And part of the reason why is because with all the moving around from Kansas City to Detroit to Milwaukee and back in the Detroit organization playing in Toledo, he's got a wife and a young child living in Kansas City. He's not enjoying the major league experience anymore. And as strange as it sounds, he just gets up and just walks away from the game. Really surprised a lot of people. He got into the construction industry for many, many years and finally looped back around into the major leagues as a scout. He said he never wanted to be a coach, but he understood the scouting side of baseball, and he was a scout for the Washington Nationals and Toronto Blue Jays, and at last count was part of the Boston Red Sox scouting group. And also I've seen that he has a second child as well, so he has two young boys. He seems to be happy at home and still keeping a finger on the pulse of the game as a scout as opposed to a player. So the Bob Hamlin story, you know, this is one of those names, and you pull the cards from the early 90s and go, oh, Bob Hamlin, I remember him. But it's one of those names where once you do a little research and you look at the backstory, the story is just amazing. And Bob Hamlin, who was a rookie of the year, who had Kansas City in the palm of his hand in 1994, just 5 years later, is walking through the dugout in Toledo saying, I'm done, and just walks away from the game, but was able to kind of reinvent himself as well and spend some quality time with his family, which is definitely a good thing to hear. And of course, like I said, looping back into baseball, getting back into the game. Well, looping back into some of these cards from the 1980s and 90s and early 2000s, this was fun. And I have to admit that the $6 Walgreens random assortment of 100 cards plus the bonus 90 Donruss pack was actually a good buy. It was a fun thing to open. And again, as I'm kind of sorting through these cards and seeing, all right, which cards do I need to complete a set? Because there's probably two or three in the stack that can help me out here. I'm really going to enjoy looking through these again. And again, looking forward to sending the remaining cards, including a lot of these star cards, those Roger Clemens, the Doc Goodens, all these other star cards that we have here that will be going into the donation box for Commons for Kids. And when we send out our next donation, it's good to know that this kind of little whim purchase of $6 is going to be going to a good cause. Well, I hope you can join me for the next podcast. Again, that'll be 2 weeks from today, Friday, November 22nd. Hopefully, I can find some good deals, not only at the local card show next weekend, but also, as I said, by request, I'll look for some 92 Fleer Ultra that we can open up and have some fun with. And we'll just see what happens in a couple of weeks. So look for the video break on Thursday, November 21st, the podcast coming out Friday, November the 22nd. And again, don't forget to make those donations, if you could, please, as all the money goes right back into the program, paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. Whether it's $2, $5, $25, or if you're just crazy and want to donate more, you can go ahead and do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. And you will keep that 90 Donruss wax pack and the 89 Bowman rack pack on the shelf in the corner, far, far away from this program. If not, I will unleash the fury of the junkiest of junk wax on you in a future show. But it won't be the next one. I will promise you that. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.